Mr. Atkinson, Real 5. We're just about to talk a little more about training as a stretcher bearer. You say it was first aid training. You carried dressings with you. Was there anything else that you had to carry with you?
No, there wasn't. I don't remember anything. No. Field dressings and...
You didn't carry some injections or that kind of thing for pain? Or
No.
Were you trained to do injections?
No. We were trained to do bandaging, do splint work for breakages, putting splints on broken limbs, and bandaging in particular, how to bandage a finger, a thumb, or put on a bandage on a broken bone, and how to hold it together. And we had quite a lot of training on that, but there was nothing to do with sort of taking somebody's blood pressure or anything like that. No, that was left to the doctors. All the stretch bear had to do was to relieve and get him, the patient, back to the correct medical centre, wherever it may be, you see. That's the training we done.
How are stretchers allocated? Is it one per two men or one man per stretcher?
One to two men, one for the front and one for the back, yes.
Mm-hmm. And did you always work with the same person in pairs?
No, I don't think you did. No, I think they were just sort of how they cropped along.
How heavy is a stretcher?
Well, a stretcher always had a blanket inside of it as well, you know. And they were quite heavy, actually. And going on route marches with that stretcher, I know you didn't have a rifle. You didn't carry a rifle when you were carrying a stretcher. But you'd go on a route, which what used to annoy me like was the fact that you'd march 20 miles in the day and it come to night time, you know. And what happened to your stretcher? You'd carried it all that way. The bloody sergeant used to take it to sleep on, didn't he? And you slept in the grass.
Were you given a sidearm if you didn't have a rifle?
No. Never seen a sidearm for years afterwards. No.
Did you have a Red Cross?
Oh, you had a band on you. You had a Red Cross band, yes. And you hadn't to go anywhere near the first aid zones with a rifle. You weren't allowed to go anywhere near them.
I suppose that was part of the convention that.
The Red Cross If you were having a rifle, if you did have rifles as well, you know, but if you were taking an injured person back to the first aid hospital, forget what they call it now, you had to leave your rifle so many hundred yards away from it when you go in there. And I remember when we were captured behind the line, the difference between how we interpreted this first aid business and how the Germans interpreted it. That was, it was a height, you know, you couldn't help but see the difference because they were coming in and stacking the Red Cross tent with all the ammunition all the way around, and we had the job of having to stack it around there. Now, it was the safest place in the world for the ammunition from our gunners and that, because we wouldn't touch it with a big Red Cross on. Well, the Germans didn't care. They didn't stick to it. And that was the first thing that struck me.
Did we stick to it?
Eh?
Did we stick to
we
it?
We stuck to it. We stuck to it far too much. I mean, if the Germans wanted anything carrying, they would just fire at one or two of these Arabs and bring them over and with a mule and use their mule to carry stuff for them while they walked alongside free as a dunce. Now, when we were emptying our combo boxes in the front line, we had to carry them bloody miles in the dark. And there was all these donkeys and that about, but we couldn't use the Arabs' donkeys like the Germans did.
Were you told from the very outset of this training that this was a dangerous job?
No, they give you a sense. I mean, you knew what was dangerous and what was done. No, it just took it as it comes.
How many stretcher bearers in a battalion?
I'd say about 12 to 14, I should think. Yeah, that's all it would be. Yeah.
Where would you be, shall we say, stationed in a action situation? I don't mean prior to being used, anything. Where was your centre?
Just back of the ongoing troops, you know.
Were you around battalion headquarters? Were you part of battalion headquarters?
No. You attached the platoon. I was a stretcher bay attached to B Company.
When you went into action, you
went in with B Company, yeah, not the headquarters. And because you had A, B, C, and D, I always think they didn't give us enough information as to where each company was allocated to an attack. You know, they never. You were in the blind, and this first time we went into action, I thought, well, this is, we're going into trouble, and after a fact, we're going into trouble. There was bloody Germans on the right high ground, and there was Germans on the left high ground, and looking down on us, and we were just running into a gap, and Jerry in front dug in, and the crossfire was just, it seems stupid, that attack we went into, where we lost a lot.
You had a stretcher bearer sergeant. He was in command of all the stretcher bearers.
He was in the HQ. Never saw much of him in action. Like he was, yeah. There was the sergeant and the corporal, and he was working from the HQ.
Did you come under the medical officer?
Oh yes, yes. Oh yeah. Well, them all, yeah. And he was back in the HQ. The first aid. I forget what they call it. It used to be the first aid sort of dressing.
The regimental aid post.
Regimental aid post. And then further back was the...
casualty clearing station.
Yeah, the hospitals and that, you know. And the sergeants then was in the first aid post. And that's where you took your casualties to.
And the doctor would be there.
Yeah.
Battalion doctor.
Yeah, doctor was there, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did the padre have a role to play where, you know, with this medical or wounded situation?
I think he was hanging about, but I don't remember seeing much of him, like. The only time I remember seeing the padre was when I was going to tell you about that first casualty we had.
We'll come to that, of course. How long did the training last?
Ooh, we were a long time at it, really, for the battalion. We must have been the best trained battalion in the whole of the British Army, because we joined up in the 40s, and it was, end of 42 before we went abroad. I know they were supplying, at the time, different personnel to different parts of the, where they needed. But as a battalion, we were, well, we worked down in Yarmouth. And
Did you start your manoeuvres and your training of that with your own unit, the bigger units, at Dunfermline, or was that a stage further?
No, I think we'd done some, for a little bit of night manoeuvres in Dunfermline.
And your role in these manoeuvres would obviously be in the stretcher bearer role.
Sometimes, but at this time, I'm telling you, when I shot this lieutenant, I mustn't have been a stretcher bearer.
Is there any other memories you've got of Dunfermline?
We weren't there a great time, and... I don't think as much happened. I just enjoyed the training around the park, and that was a nice park. And it wasn't long before they moved us to Dalkeith, didn't we?
You moved to Dalkeith?
Went down to Dalkeith, yeah. And we'd done a lot of more training there in Battle Abbey, is it?
Had you become part of a larger force, a brigade or a division?
I think we were always, from the very beginning, part of the 46th Div, and the brigade, I think there was Sherwood Foresters, and was at the court, Sherwood Forest and the Coilers, maybe in our brigade, and it was all part of the Oakleigh 46 Div from the very beginning, I think.
Do you know which brigade you were in with in the 46 Div?
Don't remember. No, don't remember.
I think the records show 139.
Yeah. I was going to say a 39, like.
With the Sherwood Foresters.
Sherwood Foresters and Leicesters, yeah. Yeah, 139.
What were you doing at Dalkeith?
Oh, more training. Weaponry and marching and drilling and all the same training that went on. And we used to have to march through the main street to the park where we used to do all the training. And we were, all of us had to be immaculate when you were doing these marches down the main streets.
How did the local people take to you?
Very, very, very friendly. They were marvellous. They were always asking you out for suppers and things like that. They would take 6, 10, anybody wanted to go for supper. And they were very, very good. They were the best people we had come across in all the time we were in the army, was the Scotch people up there. Mm-hmm.
We were at Dalkeith long.
We were at Dalkeith. We went down to Thetford January 41, and at that time I don't remember. I'd never heard of Thetford. I didn't know. I still didn't know where we were when we got down there. Soon got found out. Like, it didn't take us long to find that we weren't far away from Great Yarmouth and North Walsham and places like that. And we were under canvas again when we got down to Thetford. No, not at Thetford we weren't under canvas. It's when we moved on to Yarmouth. But at Thetford, I loved that place. It was a lovely, unspoilt country village. And we, as the stretch of bearers, were outside about 2 or 3 miles in the first aid hospital, I suppose it was. And we ran that MI room there, and where they reported for sick and that sort of thing. And we loved it out there because we used to go outside and find our own firewood and burn it and smash it down that. And I always remember, you know, when we used to go on these walks, and you think you're next to an airfield, and when you got close to it, it was a dummy. All the aeroplanes was dummies, and they were decoys, like for Grosselle or airfields around that area in them days, and they must have quite a number of these dummy airfields, and it was quite interesting, and they were bombed as well, you know. Yeah.
While you were there?
While we were there, yeah.
Did you get involved in that in any way? I don't mean shooting planes,
no, you? No, we never
helping out?
No, the most helping out we done in Thetford was fighting fires. It was a lovely summer and there was a lot of woodland there, you know, and it was, they used to use the armies for trying to keep the fires down. So I remember mostly about Thetford.
What were the people like in that area?
Not as friendly as they were up north. No, not as friendly. I think they seemed to think we were intruders when we went in the pub. They used to have late sessions for the regulars, and we got chased out, didn't we? And they weren't very friendly at all, Norfolk people, I didn't think.
Were you again into large-scale manoeuvres and training here?
Oh yeah, we'd done some heavy schemes, what you used to call them, you know.
Do you remember any in particular?
Had special names, all these schemes, Kittywick or something, these stupid names. But, there was one time which come back on leave to Thetford. Got back on leave about 11 o'clock, 10:30 at night, only to find that I had to go on a manoeuvre in the early hours of the morning. I don't know what they call that manoeuvre. I think it was one of it must have been one of Murray's manoeuvres. And it used to last all night, just marching, and we, what we do is stretch about, is carry a stretcher around after them all, you know. But nothing spectacular can I remember in Thetford or Yarmouth. Well, are we in yet? We're not to Yarmouth yet, are we?
You had a change of commanding officer whilst you were at Thetford.
Yeah, that must have been Murray. He took over from Colonel Weir, didn't he? Was it Weir?
Seabag Montefiore.
Eh?
Seabag Montefiore, he took over.
He was our original doings, but...
then Murray.
Weir must have taken over from Murray, yeah.
Was Murray like?
Oh, great. We thought he was great. He was a real soldier, I think, Murray. And we liked him as a commander, yes.
Was he a young man or elderly?
He was in his 40s, and but he was a very sort of sprightly type of soldier. He looked like a soldier, and I think he treated you like a soldier. I think he's very good, Murray. We all liked him.
By now, you've been soldiering through, although you'd just missed Dunkirk, you've been soldiering through... a pretty bad time for the country with defeats here and there and so forth.
Oh yeah, the Battle of Britain, wasn't it?
What were your spirits like hearing all the bad news and you're still in England?
Well, I'll tell you what I was thinking when I was up in Edinburgh for start off and the Battle of Britain was going on at the time. I was wish I was down there to see it all going on. You know, it felt as though you were missing something. And when we moved south to Thetford, I thought we'd be really among it there. But I didn't even know where Thetford was, but I knew it was a lot further south than what Edinburgh was. And we were at Thetford, we must have been there a few months before we went to Yarmouth.
What were you doing at Yarmouth?
Building anti-tank defences on the beach. These, what do they call the poles? Scaffolding. You're putting on this scaffolding and building it all the way to the beach, and it was supposed to be an anti-tank hindrance. And I think the engineers come along, and on the other side of it, they were laid mines, didn't they?
And did you get into this building situation?
Oh yes, I was helping to build the dunes, the scaffolding. Yes, I think we were all involved in that. There was a heck of a lot to be done in a short time. And of course that was two places where they were expecting to have an invasion, was the south of England, round about the Rye, Winchelsea, Folkestone area, or Great Yarmouth, because that's where it was so ever so flat, wasn't it? And all that. We were in Yarmouth for 4 weeks, and I don't remember one day during that 4 weeks where we didn't have a bomber over. It wasn't mass bombing there, but it was every day they'd drop one or two and away. And Yarmouth took a hell of a battering, really. Mass bombing.
Did you get involved with that again? Did it affect you in any way?
Didn't affect us in any way, no. We were living in posh hotels, but they weren't posh like when we were in them, because there was no carpet or nothing in them, but that's where we were, along the front in Yarmouth, and we were straight off the hotel, across the road, onto the beach, where we were building these defences. And then we moved away from Yarmouth to Worcester Park, I think it was, somewhere... airfields, besides some airfields, and we were under canvas again then, and got to Worcester Park, and the weather wasn't very good either.
So you were under, again, quite muddy conditions.
Muddy conditions.
And was part of your work here with airfield defence?
Airfield defence, that's what the battalion was doing, yeah.
And you moved there, as you say, you were only in Yarmouth about 4 weeks.
4 weeks, I think, in Yarmouth, yeah. And we
have you any memories of Worcester Park? What you were doing there? What
no.
You were doing there personally?
The only thing I remember is playing cards all weekend. No, there was a pretty static time. We were there just in case of an invasion, and they kept us training, of course, you know, doing on marches to keep us fit, but nothing dramatic there at all until they moved down to the south coast.
Were you considering yourselves by now a very well-trained battalion?
We all thought we were, yes, yeah. We thought we were, yeah.
Where did you go to after Worcester Park?
I think we went down to Shawncliffe then, Shawncliffe Barracks, and that was where the spit and polish all started. And I remember, mind you, you had to be spick and span there, because the bloody generals and eye officers was always coming around inspecting the guard. And I remember one incident. There was this bloke called White. From the time we had joined up, he had worked in the Cougars. And they decided, when we got to Shawncliffe Barracks, that they didn't want him in the Cougars. He was too scruffy. And I remember being on guard that night. And of course, the first thing they do when they toss you out the Cougars into a platoon, they put you on guard. Well, he was put on guard, and I don't think he'd ever known what a bit of blanco was. He'd never done nothing in the way of doing. Well, we were all this posh guard all lined up, and for a start off, he was late, and then we see him trailing across, you know. And you've never seen such a scruffy item in all your life. His pack was flat against his back, where yours all had to be squared and everything, and polished brasses, and he'd come there, and he was absolutely scruffy, so he was on about three charges before he got lined up. So he was standing next to me in the line, you know. And they come to fix bayonets. And everybody went, bump, kick. Not him. Sergeant, what's that man doing? No bayonets, sir. No bayonets there. So the sergeant pulls his bayonet out and clacks it on his dome there, young. Unfixed bayonet. He's still standing there. What's the matter with that man? Two bayonets. He's the one that slipped out the back, and he tried to push it in there, and he had a bloody bayonet in the other sergeant. Well, talk about laughing. Yeah, we dismissed and got on guard. Oh, yeah, he got in the charge because his rifle was bloody filthy, you know. Get that clean by you dismount or else you're in trouble. So he gets into the guard room and he started cleaning his rifle. But instead of using 4x2, he must have used about 6x2, you see. So very soon, it stuck. Had it jammed in his rifle. So one of the lads on the guard says, listen, toss it over the door, he says, and I'll hold onto this end and you pull down. Well, what happens was the bloody cord snapped, didn't it? And out of his rifle was just three or four strands of dunes going on. When he dismounted guard that next morning, there he was, inspecting rifle with him with his cord sticking This was this White. And I remember the sergeant major coming up to me and he says, go and get rid of that booker. You know, every week you used to have maybe about six or seven for Burma or from far afield doing. He's going this weekend. So there you are. He was on one of the
drafts.
And he'd never done anything except and work in the cookhouse. And the God help us. If they're sending all them out there, God knows what was coming out as reinforcements.
So they're basically tending to send the ones they didn't want.
That's right.
Out on draft.
Yes, yeah. That's the ones they sent out on draft. On these olden companies, they didn't get rid of their best men because they wanted a good, smart battalion. But they must have sent a load of people that couldn't. I mean, this Billy Hall I was telling you about earlier on. I remember him with a brain gun, you know, the Doones. They sent him out there, and I remember the first time I was on the range with him. With a brain gun, the bullets was just flying off 6 yards in front of him. And I remember the officer saying to the sergeant, "Sergeant, have a look at that gun. There's something wrong with it." And the sergeant said, "There's nothing wrong with the gun, sir. It's the bloody man." And he went on draft.
You mentioned guard duties. Could we dwell a little on time on that? Obviously, the standard of turnout would have to be absolutely spot on.
It was when you were absolutely in the barracks, particularly when you were in, like, the Shawncliffe barracks. That would be real spot on there, yeah. Yeah. Even at Thetford, they used to have schemes where if there were six went on guard, they used to pick seven. And one used to get dismissed from guard, who was the best man on the guard. And that meant examining shoes, the studs and everything, you know. Yeah, of course, everybody, the competition was terrific. Got to get away from a guard was terrific. And of course, it was very, very... It used to get a little bit wrong as well, because you used to get people sabotaging the equipment and that, you know, to make sure that they didn't... You know, if somebody got what you call a stick, I think they called it, the guard stick, if he got it a couple of times running, somebody would sabotage his kit before he went out, you know. Pour some oil on his weapon and things, that sort of thing.
And what was the stick man's job once he was appointed?
He was dismissed. Free to go out, no more guard, you see. So it was a big incentive to dodge the guard, wasn't it?
Can you take me through the guard situation, forming the guard and how it was done?
Well, your guard used to last, I think, from 6 o'clock in the evening till 6 o'clock in the morning, and used to do 2 hours on and four off. So there was 4 hours and four. Yeah, so it must have been an 8 hour period, and you'd done two on, four off, then two again. So you're like four hours, 12 hours. It was a 12 hour period. Yeah, 6 till 6. So, if you went on first, which was 6 till 8, you didn't go on again till 12 o'clock, and you'd done 12 till 2, and that was you finished. You say.
What would you do for the 2 hours you were on?
Stand on guard.
Just standing there.
Well, you used to take you to the different points where the guard was needed. It might be at the gates. It might be a guard in the cookhouse. And you have a guard commander, and he's responsible for seeing that the shifts moved over correctly. And then you went into the guard room during your 4 hours off. Now, during your 4 hours off, you weren't allowed to undress or anything like that, but you used to lie under a blanket and get a bit kip. And... weren't supposed to keep at all, like, but you did do during your 4 hours. And the guard commander had to see to that you were ready to take your shift turn and everything, you see. And once during the night, at least, the orderly officer used to come and inspect the guard and inspect the guard room to see you were all awake and ready for anything that was coming up. That used to happen once a night.
And that would be unannounced?
Unannounced, come round any time, yeah. The ordinary officer would come round unannounced, and sometimes you'd find you're all asleep, like, in the guard room. And if the guard commander was fast asleep, he was in trouble, wasn't he?
And guard commander would be an NCO, is that right?
Well, the guard commander was always a corporal or a sergeant. He was always a corporal or a sergeant, yeah, as guard commander.